Well, this speaking was spontaneous. It was not thought out in advance. At least that was the theory. Of course, a friend might harbor a concern and let it germinate in his mind through the week or a month until finally he felt that it was ready to give to the meeting. He wouldn't plan in advance to give it. He would simply say, if I feel that this is the right time for it, then I will give it. It would not be good Quakerism to plan a communication in advance. Well, of course, while they were sitting at home reading the Bible or some religious book, ideas would come to them which they could later use in meeting, perhaps. Well, when this catalog of 1725 was published, it contained, I think, 26 journals that had been printed and completed, and more than about the same number that were not finished and published, and it contained 90 not complete journals, but simply accounts which friends had written of the reasons why they came into the Society of Friends or the particular circumstances which brought them into the Society. You sometimes, in reading Quaker histories, get the feeling that these traveling ministers would speak in marketplaces and orchards and open meadows, and crowds would come to hear them, as they generally did, and that they would make a number of converts while they spoke. But it's very seldom, I don't know of a single case, of a person who came into the Society of Friends from listening to a speaker addressing a crowd, like Billy Sunday does, for instance. They generally came into the Society of Friends by wandering, by accident or intention, into some meeting in a living room of a farmhouse, probably about the size of this one, and probably containing not more people than are here now. And in that small meeting, where there was more intimacy and more feeling of communication and feeling of fellowship, that was the thing which generally brought them in. And Quakerism began with small meetings in homes, and when the larger meeting houses were built, and only those could speak who were good speakers and able to address larger audiences, then I think the Society of Friends became somewhat weaker. In the small meetings, people had less hesitancy about saying what they thought or felt. In the large meetings, they hesitated a good deal more. And for that reason, I think the large meetings were not as powerful, not as strong, as the smaller ones. Well, these journals were never published during the lifetime of the writer. I don't know of a single one that was. Usually the manuscript was discovered by his children or someone else, and it would be handed over to a committee of the meeting to which he belonged. That committee would read the manuscript and probably make some revisions. Sometimes it needed revisions. His grammar was not always what it should be. Sometimes he mentioned persons still living in a way that was not very complimentary, and of course that would have to be eradicated. Sometimes he said things that the committee thought would not be to the honor and glory of the Society of Friends, and very often those were some of the most interesting parts of the journal. So this editing was not always to the advantage of the journal. We have the two most famous journals are those of George Fox and John Woolman, and we have the original manuscripts of both of those journals, so we know exactly how much they were edited. a person called Thomas Elwood, who wrote a very interesting journal, one of the best descriptions of the England of the 17th century that I know of. But he was a rather pedantical sort of person, and he didn't like some of the things that George Fox said. George Fox dictated his journal to his son-in-law when he was in prison, and that particular journal ended in 1675, and Fox did not die till 1691. So Elwood not only edited the journal up to 1675, but he wrote the rest of it himself, getting it mostly from Fox's letters and from the diaries of persons that traveled with Fox to America and Germany and other places. And so from 1675 on, it's not really Fox's journal at all. So the latest edition of Fox's journal, and by far the best one, best edited one, which contains everything that Fox put in originally, was published in 1952, the 300th anniversary of the beginning of the Society of Friends. And I would recommend the reading of that particular edition rather than the earlier one, sometimes called the Elwood edition. Elwood was a learned man. He was John Milton's secretary, and he used to read to John Milton in Latin. And he says that John Milton was very useful to him because John Milton corrected his pronunciation. He had been taught a different pronunciation in his school. He was the son of a wealthy English squire or country gentleman, and had a very good education. Milton showed him the document of Paradise Lost. Milton had moved from the country to from the city to the country because of the plague in London, and Elwood had found him what he called a pretty box, a place called Chalfont, which you can visit if you go to that part of England. It's still kept to the sort of Milton shrine, although he was only there part of 1 year. And he showed Elwood Paradise Lost, and Elwood hopped over the hedges and took it home, he didn't live far away, and read it. And when he came back, he said to Milton, "Thou hast written now of Paradise Lost, thou must next write of Paradise Regained." And Milton did. And Elton believes that he was the one who inspired the writing of Paradise Regained. It wasn't altogether a fortunate suggestion, because Paradise Regained is not nearly so well written, not nearly so good a poem as Paradise Lost. Because in Paradise Lost, the main character is the devil, and he's rather interesting, and makes the plot much more exciting than that of Paradise Regained. Well, this editing didn't always change very much. Elwood would cut out a number of Fox's dreams, and the editor of Woman's Journal cut out a number of Woman's dreams. They have fortunately all been put back in the latest editions. When Fox would praise himself in any way, Elwood would cut that out. For instance, when Fox rode through Oxford, he was jeered and by the students, and things were bricks and stones were thrown at him, and he said, "The light burst out around my head and ears." Well, of course, I would cut that out. That wouldn't sound very good enough. And some of the miracles that Fox thought he had performed. Fox thought of himself as a prophet, like the Hebrew prophets. They were able to perform miracles, and since he was a prophet and spoke in the name of the Lord, or the Lord spoke through him, why couldn't he perform miracles? And he wrote a book of miracles. And that, apparently, has either been lost or destroyed. I rather suspect that friends were ashamed of it and didn't permit it to be published and so we don't have it. But Henry Cadbury reconstructed it from the index. The index was saved. And the index referred to the miracles in other documents and in various journals of persons that knew Fox and traveled with him. So Henry was able to restore a very large part of this book of miracles of Fox, which has never been published or completely known. Now these journals are not literary gems. I think Woolman is. It's used now in a number of colleges as an English classic, because it's written in a beautiful, plain, straightforward style with no flourishes, no attempts at fancy writing. You see, the Quakers believed in simplicity. Simplicity in dress, in furniture, in behavior, in speech. And if you believed in simplicity in speech, your speech would have to be very plain and simple and direct, and not adorned with any extravagant metaphors or figures of speech. So they represent simple statements of facts without without any effort to produce literature. And I think in many respects they're all the better for that. They leaned over backwards, you might say, in their efforts to tell the truth. The Friends very early became famous for always telling the truth. They suffered a great deal because of their refusal to take an oath. They had resolved to follow the teachings of the New Testament literally and completely, the only Christian sect that has ever made that endeavor. And Jesus said, swear not at all. So I've heard that interpreted as meaning swear not at some, but not at all. But of course he didn't mean that. And so they refused to take an oath, and the writer of the Epistle of James also forbids oaths. And because they refused to swear, they suffered more from that than from any other one thing. Because if you wanted to put a Quaker in prison, and that happened pretty often, Quakers could make themselves very troublesome sometimes by refusing to do what was expected of them, sitting quietly and listening to a preacher without interrupting him, for instance. They would be offered the oath of allegiance to the king. That, of course, was after the days of Cromwell. Quakerism arose during Cromwell's revolution. But in 1660, Charles II came to the throne, and in 1662 an act was passed making it a criminal offense for anyone to go to a Quaker meeting. And of course the Quakers went just as much as ever. They completely disregarded that law, and thousands of them suffered in prison, and many died there because of this act, which was called the Quaker Act, because it was aimed directly at the Quakers. They also violated a good many other acts. I think some friends would be surprised today to learn that one act they did violate was that they did things on the Sabbath, which the Puritans, who were in control during Cromwell's days, forbid. The Quakers held that every day was just as holy as every other day. That's why they refused to celebrate Easter and Christmas and days like that. All days are equally holy. And so the Sabbath day is just as holy as any other day. Why be holy on the Sabbath day and unholy on other days? But they said, we keep the Sabbath because it's important that one day in the week be set aside for rest and religious devotion. And that's just a matter of convenience. It's not a matter of religion. So many of them were arrested for not keeping the Sabbath. you couldn't travel on the Sabbath day. And of course, friends did. They went about from one meeting to another. And some of them even did business on the Sabbath. Well, that's a testimony that friends have completely forgotten, and I doubt hardly any Quaker today knows that it ever existed.